This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer squad, and I want to talk about your mail, not the kind that comes into your inbox, but old-fashioned snail mail that some of us still get delivered to our homes. Canada Post just reported staggering losses and warns of more to come. So will we see more cuts or even an end to mail delivery as we know it? And let's talk about pensions and money and big questions around how and when to collect CPP and OAS. And when it comes to Zoomer Health, we'll check in on the campaign to get more of the latest vaccines covered by Medicare. What do you think about all that? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'm joined by Bill Van Gorder, Chief Advocacy and Education Officer of CARP, Anthony Quinn, Chief Community Officer at CARP, and Dave Kurzinski, Research Director of the Angus Reid Institute. Hello and welcome.
Hi, Libby.
Okay, let's begin with Bill. And Bill, I remember this was a big issue for CARP back when it first started those, what do you call those big boxes, especially in rural areas, ending home delivery to some places. So are we all used to that, or are these losses a big concern?
This is a real problem for us. And yes, when the community mailboxes came in, CARP worked very hard to both stop it from happening in some communities who still get house-to-house delivery, but also to make sure there were alternate levels of delivery available for seniors who weren't able to get out of the house and get to their local boxes. That was some years ago. Things have changed now. Many more of our CARP members are using online, using email, not using snail mail as they used to. But there's still a large portion who depend on mail. We often talk with companies who, for instance, who want to go strictly to delivering their invoices online, and pointing out to them that many seniors are not able to deal that way. So it is becoming a problem. And interesting to me, the way Canada Post seems to solve a problem of having less use is by raising the price. It just doesn't make sense.
Anthony, what have you been hearing about this?
Well, we mentioned the dental care plan the last few shows, Libby, and that is one example where the Canada Post mail delivery service was almost invaluable in being able to allow the seniors to get notice of the dental plan, to register themselves, and to be ready to take advantage of it when it comes into place. So there's no doubt that snail mail is still important to our demographic. As Bill said, they are moving on to the latest and greatest technologies, but I don't think the tax base can afford billion-dollar losses at a Crown corporation either.
Dave, is there, do you think, a demographic divide where perhaps an older demographic values Canada Post a lot more than a younger demographic?
Yeah, to me, we asked this question. It was a few years ago. But I think that it likely holds up. And this is just the question of, does Canada Post provide an essential service? And we also asked, is this kind of a hallmark of a developed country? Because for a lot of people, they think, you know, it's Canada. We should be able to run and operate a door-to-door mail service. And older Canadians, the 65-plus group, are the most likely to say that this is a hallmark of a developed country. So 67% say that. For younger people, they tend to be a little more skeptical. They're kind of growing up in a world where you get packages from Amazon or FedEx, and you don't really see Canada Post in the way that, maybe we used to. But there is a sense among older Canadians that this will cause issues and kind of disproportionate suffering to rural and older residents if we do go the way of cutting services, kind of condensing services to community mailbox. We really did see that in the data. And we've got this question of, you know, if we lose home mail delivery, will it pose hardship for Canadians? And the 65-plus group, 85% say that they agree that it would cause some hardship. So I think it's certainly a big problem to solve. And there's a little bit more of a national identity, I think, for older Canadians with the mail service, because it's something that, you know, I say we grew up with. I'm just about 40, but I feel like I predated the internet, so I feel like I can say we. It's something we grew up with, and it's a big issue to solve, I think, for you know, modernizing this service, but also keeping it reliable and recognizable.
Now, I remember when there was talk about using Canada Post and the people delivering their mail to check in on vulnerable seniors and other people. And there are models for this in other countries. I saw it written up with great fanfare, and then poof, you hear nothing about it, Bill.
Yeah, you're right, and that was proposed. It was actually proposed by the postal workers union, who knew that their people often do fulfill that kind of role, even unofficially, because they are often the only visitor that comes to the door of many seniors who don't have friends and family nearby. It was a wonderful idea. We certainly supported it and continue to support that kind of looking after your neighbors program. But it sounded good at the time, but there was no follow through.
And Anthony, on the other hand, the union is very political, using resources to embrace the anti-Israel cause.
Yeah, unfortunately, the CUPW really do focus most of their advocacy on international issues, a lot of it against Israel, less so on their domestic concerns about the survival of Canada Post itself. The other idea that they had was beyond the seniors check-in service was some kind of mail banking service where your postal carrier would also be your banker who could help you make deposits and withdrawals and things like that.
Ooh, but I wouldn't want that.
No, I think that digital technology has surpassed those ideas. And I think Bill might even agree that if we were going to invest in someone checking in on seniors at the rates we Canada Post would charge, we would want some trained PSWs or other caregivers to be the ones checking in, not just the mail carrier.
Bill?
Well, that's probably true. Although this was just a health check with arrangements to refer to the kind of professionals that Anthony's talking about. And with regard to the Postal Service being used as a bank, of course, in Britain, that's been the case for some time. And anybody who has watched the recent news about the terrible kerfuffle over how that was handled by their national service certainly doesn't make it look like that would be a good idea in Canada either.
I can't imagine that would be a good idea, but the health check-in service, I forget which country it works in, but it apparently does work elsewhere. Again, you know, Anthony, you pointed out this very militant kind of a union, so maybe having that kind of a gentle role doesn't suit them. Moving along to money, I mean, we had our tax deadline last week, so some people are getting refunds. And it's also, once you're thinking about your finances, one big question that a lot of Zoomers have to grapple with, and it's when to take your CPP and your OAS, because you can delay it until the age of 70. And if you do that, you get a lot more money, but obviously for a shorter period of time. Bill?
Yeah, it's always a question for people as they reach an age that they're eligible to get these payments. And it's really, I think, you know, the bottom line is you've got to get good professional advice because situations are different. It depends how much money you have now, if you're still working, what your savings are like, what your health condition is like, how long you might expect to live. It's very complicated, you know. And one of the worst problems we have is we don't have good what we call financial literacy among Canadians in general. We don't even teach it in our schools anymore. And people really don't know what they don't know and don't know enough to ask these questions. They make decisions based on maybe something they've heard or some traditional way of doing it in their family. And then they find for them it wasn't the right decision. And certainly we always recommend to people they see a qualified, seniors, knowledgeable financial professional before they make the decision of when and if they're going to take these payments.
Well, they've paid in. So if, I think, is an easy question to answer. Dave, you've done some work on this.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we've noticed, certainly since COVID-19 and this inflationary kind of crisis that we're going through, is that not only are Canadians trying to cut back from discretionary spending, they're kind of deferring their RRSP contributions, TFSA contributions, and a lot of people are kind of dipping into those savings accounts. So not only are we not maybe you know, knowledgeable enough about the financial aspects of it to decide when to start drawing down, a lot of people are you know, taking early contributions from some savings and plans that they would be using in their retirement. So I think that's one of the trends that we're worried about that we're seeing over the last, you know, particularly 18 months to 2 years, but something that you know, every time we do a study of financial kind of situations, we do see high levels of stress. And one of the things that we're seeing among the 65 plus group is that a lot of people in that age demographic are worse off financially than they were last year. You know, when you ask that question of people who are, you know, of retirement age, you would hope that people are sustaining, that they're, you know, when they look at 12 months ago, they look and say, you know, I'm in about the same situation. That's the stability that we want with these programs. We've got 41% of the 65 plus group saying that they're actually worse off financially now than they were last year. When you look at how big of a one-time expense that could pop up that they'd be able to absorb, only half say that they're kind of comfortable with whatever pops up. You've got, you know, about 25% who say if it was $200 or more, that would put them in a really tight spot. So it gives you a sense of the tension, the kind of tightrope that a lot of seniors are walking already as we discuss, you know, how to best utilize these programs. So we're in a bit of a tough spot, I think, you know, in a lot of areas of the country.
Anthony, a couple of things. So first of all, in your experience, are people even aware that they can defer getting these payments and, of course, paying taxes on them and it increases their income? And speaking of feeling less well off, I was surprised last week on Thursday, I did an item on people co-signing mortgages with their kids. And that can set you back if your adult child ends up not being able to pay the mortgage, even if that's what they agreed to do. So I know that helping out adult children is a big expense for a lot of people.
We're hearing, I think, similar to the polls, that the inflation and just the pressures on the pocketbooks of our members is really something they're feeling. But as for the old age security, CARP was instrumental in ensuring that everyone who reached age 65 was automatically enrolled. What was happening prior to that was people would turn age 65, not enroll, and then they would miss those years of payment, and the government was unlikely to give people the owed money. So now everyone who turns age 65 is automatically enrolled in old age security. So if you want to defer, if that's what you and your financial planner agree is best for you, you have to apply for that. So that's something to remember when someone's turning 65. You have to make that decision.
My understanding is that you have to ask for it if you want to get it.
Not any longer. You're automatically enrolled now.
But you don't get it automatically without asking for it.
That's how the law has changed with CARP's action. Now, if you want to delay it, you have to let them know.
Okay. I think I know of people who have had the opposite instruction, saying, let us know if you want to get the money. But one thing to check out there.
And just on that number, Libby, so if you delay for 5 years with old age security, you're foregoing about $42,000 on average. So that $42,000 is sitting with the government, not in your hands. And if you or your partner passes away the day before you turn 70, that money is gone and it can't be passed on. And there's no compensatory money for a surviving spouse. So the bird in the hand is I think what most of our seniors in Canada are still doing, the majority of them. And financial advisor will have to give people the best advice.
Right. But on the other hand, people who defer, I mean, my husband deferred it because he was still working, get a bigger payout if they wait till they're 70.
They certainly do. And it takes about 5 years to break even again. So living to age 82 or 83, depending on your tax bracket, is when you start to break even. And then you're making more money than having deferred it, if you deferred it.
That's interesting. Okay. I'm going to take a call from Bill in Scarborough. Hi, Bill.
Good day, Lily. My thoughts were always, you never knew how long you were going to live. So I took my old age Canada pension and my RIF at 65. You know, I wasn't, because like the gentleman said before, there's a lot of money that's sitting there, and if you pass away, you lose it all. So my thought was take the money early, put it in your tax-free account, and enjoy it while you still have your health. Because if you wait till you're 75 or 80, you know, who knows?
Exactly. So
I thought it was just beneficial just to take it now or take it early. And I'm 74 now, and I'm still healthy, so maybe if I'd waited, I would have got more money.
Okay, well, it's just one of those things that you have to make your best guess because none of us know. Are you happy with your decision, Bill?
Yes. Yeah. No, everything's worked out fine. We're comfortable and it worked out just fine.
Okay, thanks.
So I recommend to take it early because, like you say, you just never know.
Thanks for that.
Another reason, Libby, to take it early if you are a low-income senior is that you don't qualify for the GIS unless you take the OAS. So deferring old age security necessarily means you don't receive the GIS and there's no increase in the GIS for delaying. So if you are in need of or qualify for GIS, the best advice is to take old age security when it's available to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm assuming people who are low income are taking CPP. It's that it's people who are high income who are deferring it. Makes sense. Moving along to our health. So there has been a campaign underway to get governments, and I say plural because it's different in every province, to cover more of the latest vaccines. How's that going, Bill?
It's not going as quickly or as well as our members want it to. There's a patchwork of work across the country with different provinces doing differently. There's rumors of changes for next year that some of the provinces are going to be cutting back on some of their support because they think the federal government should pick up more of the cost. Our CARP basic philosophy is what we want is good preventative medicine. And vaccines are preventative. If we give people vaccines now, it's going to save all kinds of money and health woes down the line. And governments don't seem to get that yet. They simply seem to be looking at the dollar cost of doing it straightforward without any thought to being preventive in the long run.
We have a lot of that in our health system all the way down. I'm going to take a call from Bill, who also wants to talk about money. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Libby. I've actually been retired for about 6 days now.
6 days?
6 days.
How's it going?
Today it's a beautiful day. They're all good now. But my wife and I, around 61 or 62, we took our CPP and we just invested it every month. And we figured, we did the math, we figured we banked about $80,000. And the dividend will make up the shortfall for taking it early. And then there's $80,000 that can grow in the bank over time that my kids will inherit.
Well, I think you're a pretty financially savvy guy, Bill.
Well, believe me, I've worked a long time. I want to make my money work for me at this point.
And are you happy with that decision to take it at 62?
100%, and well invested. I think, actually, Libby, if I'll be making more money when I retire than if I stop investing it, I'll be making more when I retire than working. So it's all good.
It's all good. Okay. Well, enjoy that. That sounds like a good plan. Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Okay, back to our health. Anthony, again, with the vaccines, what are you hearing from CARP members?
Well, CARP members should know that the latest COVID vaccine is now available to those over age 65 who haven't had COVID in the last 3 months. So I think it's time for them to speak to their doctor and make sure they're up to date on vaccinations that they're due for. COVID continues to circulate, particularly around older and immunocompromised adults. I'm dealing with parents who live in long-term care and assisted living homes, and COVID continues to circulate amongst those communities. And I think taking advantage of the free and readily available vaccines and talking to your doctor about the COVID shot, very important at this time.
Dave, I think a lot of people like COVID, they've forgotten about it.
Yeah, I think that it is one of those situations where we asked recently about COVID-19 and there's a lot of confusion. You know, a lot of people can't even remember the last time that they got vaccinated. I think that there's so much going on in our lives and everybody's, you know, subsumed by the latest news story that if you ask somebody if they've been vaccinated against COVID-19 over the last 6 months, they look back and trying to, you know, without a card or something to really remember the date, we're finding a lot of confusion about that. In addition to just generally people, not so much in the older age groups where vaccination rates are still much higher than kind of the rest of the general population. But younger Canadians really kind of checking out on this, and it does seem like it's going the route of the flu vaccine, where it's going to be people who are older and more at risk taking it, and kind of just pushed off by younger Canadians. So it'll be interesting to watch in the next couple of years how this all plays out. But I think your panel makes a really good point that it, you know, from government communication standpoint, for people who are at risk and people who are maybe older, we really do need to increase the level of communication and awareness of availability, because we're seeing that on a number of fronts. Just a lot of confusion that we did not see when everybody was focused on this and we were rolling out the vaccines.
Okay, well, another good message from CARP. You can get your vaccine now, so go ahead and do it. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Anthony Quinn, Bill Van Gorder, and Dave Kurzinski. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Libby.
Thanks, good
day. Bye. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about those encampments, particularly the one in U of T. We've seen and heard video. The university has done nothing and is allowing masked protesters, many of whom have no connection to the university, to decide who gets onto the campus. And guess what? They don't want Jews there when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. As we have been reporting since last week, the U of T, University of Toronto Administration, has made no move to dismantle the anti-Israel encampment. Not only that, they are allowing the masked protesters, many of whom have no connection to the university, to control access to that part of the campus. And those people are singling out Jews. Take a listen.
Please, guys.
Certainly you're not afraid of a camera, are you?
It's one of yours. What are yours?
You can bring a police here. In my mind, just bring police here. Police here, bring them. Or maybe bring them, because I would like to get in.
We don't want to call the police. They're working on that right now.
Do you think they're not letting you in because they think...
Because I'm Jewish.
Because you have an Israeli accent?
Correct. Because I'm Jewish. Because I'm. They know where I'm coming from. They just want to get me.
Well, that definitively puts the lie to those who claim that the protests are not anti-Semitic. And we've been hearing a lot lately about the targeting of Jewish students and faculty on campus and how unsafe it can be for them. And finally, the Prime Minister has addressed it. We just heard that on the noon news. He was giving a speech right before noon. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And right now, let's go to Jay Solomon, who is the Chief Advancement Officer of Hillel Ontario. Hillel is a campus Jewish organization. And Yotam Gabay, who is a student at U of T and is about to begin graduate studies. Thanks for joining us and welcome. Yotam, what's it been like on campus?
It's been a very difficult situation over the last around 8 months. Jewish and Israeli students are feeling really vulnerable on campus right now. You know, there's all these institutions and mechanisms that are in place. They're supposed to be keeping us safe. And in many cases, the very same people that are claiming to champion diversity and inclusion and stand against hatred are simply letting us down. You know, I'm very thankful that this encampment is occurring at a time when exam season is wrapping up and most students can choose to physically avoid it. But, you know, there's convocation coming up in about a month. And, you know, many students like myself are looking at returning to campus in the fall with an incredible sense of just uncertainty about the future and what kind of environment we're going to be forced to pursue our studies in. You know, there's this feeling that there's just this active hate movement against, you know, Israeli and Jewish students on campus. And no one deserves having to try to deal with that when they're trying to pursue an education. And, you know, it's really just a microcosm of what society is being like in anti-Semitism in terms of academia is a bubble. And, you know, I've had peers and others who have, you know, even gone as far as supporting October 7th and, you know, having to deal with that and what your place is in Canadian society as a Jew and as a student. It's been difficult. And, you know, every week there's just more and more and more news and more things going on that are just really hitting so close to home.
It's
just really difficult.
Jay, what's your experience with the students you work with?
Yeah, well, I've been doing this work about 16 years now, and at Hillel Ontario, we track anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism across the province. And I can tell you that this year we've seen reports over 500 incidents across the 9 universities that we staff. To give you context, last year we received about 55 reports. So it's really been staggering since this fall, and certainly since since October the 7th. And we look at what's going on now at the U of T and at McMaster and others, and you've got these campuses who are being occupied by off-campus activists, agitators, who are coming to campus, as you said, to really create chaos. And, you know, it serves to make Jewish students and Jewish faculty and Jewish staff feel intimidated, singled out, harassed, targeted, displaying really awful anti-Semitic imagery, slogans. And the time has come. The universities have a responsibility to ensure student safety, and we're calling on them to take action.
By the way, we have made repeated requests for interviews with executives from the University of Toronto, with spokespeople for the University of Toronto. They have turned down those requests. They're saying we prefer to dialogue directly with the protesters. At the beginning, they did give an ultimatum, which they completely ignored and backed off of. So that is the response from U of T. They say they're not doing interviews at this time, certainly not with us.
And Libby, I'll tell you, we have great relationships with the university administration, but this has been completely mishandled. As you said, the deadline has come and gone. You know, now the university has a very challenging situation that they need to try and manage. But, you know, they have a responsibility first and foremost to ensure Jewish students are safe, and they have a responsibility to do something about it.
Well, they aren't doing anything about it. Yotam, what do you make of the fact that they're actually, I haven't seen any reporter on the scene ask those protesters, why are you covering your face? Like, what are you doing that you are covering your face? And they are the ones controlling access. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think there's a few different factors. Part of it just has to do with the fact that, you know, a lot of the way that people are covering their faces in a lot of ways is meant to, you know, literally make themselves look like members of Hamas, like Hamas spokespeople, because they see themselves in that way as revolutionaries in some sense. Even if it's not necessary, people are covering their face because it, you know, it serves to create like a victimization that they feel, you know, that there's, you know, they need to hide their face. And it also, of course, you know, it's so that when people, you know, commit hate crimes, say hate speech, you know, it's more difficult for the police. It's more difficult for administrators to identify them. And it's also just supposed to create fear. It's supposed to, you know, it's a natural instinct to fear the unknown, and purposefully making yourself unknown is meant to intimidate.
Okay, let's take a couple of calls. We've got Karen in Bolton, and Karen just asked the question, why are they covering their faces? And our guest Yotam had a theory about that. What do you think, Karen?
Well, if you want to be anonymous, I mean, why are you protesting something if you don't believe in it? I mean, you've got to be out there, and if that's how you feel, then show yourself as to how you feel. Don't wear your mask. I don't understand it myself personally. That's my take.
Okay. Let's hear from Sheila in Mississauga. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. I spoke about this before, that we have to nip this in the bud before it starts. Nobody's listening. Nobody's doing. I guess the laws have to change. They are old laws which we are implementing, and the society has changed in every way. But we have not changed the laws. We have to change the laws, otherwise there is trouble brewing in the future for a lot of people, because a lot of people have come from everywhere to Canada to find freedom, but we are held hostage here. The Canadians who live here are held hostage. Now you tell me, where's the justice?
Today I'm just wondering, thank you very much, Sheila, for your call. If the tide is finally turning, because a lot of people who were very supportive are finally seeing, I don't know if I'm being overly optimistic, wishful thinking, are finally seeing these protesters for what they are, and that is anti-Semitic. Do you have any sense, Jay Solomon, that the tide is turning?
Well, I think what's fair to say is that the overwhelming majority of Canadians have no interest in this. They have no interest in the divisive, hateful messaging of those who support Hamas, of those who support the October 7th attacks. And I think that, to your point, that most people look at these encampments exactly the way you've articulated, that this is not something that's appealing to them. And I think that if there's small concessions in any of this, I think that that should be one of them. Most people, and I've watched them as I've stood on campus, most people walk past this. They want nothing to do with this. And I think the longer that these occupations of the campuses continue, the more negative sentiments that the organizers are going to get thrown their way.
And Yotam, what about on the university? One of the things that's very troubling to a lot of people is the sense that this type of hate is very pervasive among young people. It's normalized.
Yeah, I think it's just it's really sad that this is the state that society is going in. And I think people haven't, you know, there's been all these efforts in place for diversity and equity and inclusion, but Jewish students have felt left out by a lot of that. And, you know, it's in many cases not just a mistake that it just so happens that, you know, we're having these patterns that continue and continue where Jewish students end up being the ones that are targeted and being the ones having to face hate in a way that no other group is. And, you know, in many cases, institutions are, you know, they're complicit in it. They're not doing enough to discourage it. You know, the university has clear rules against this encampment and, you know, all the hate speech that we've seen, and they've even released statements about how much line is being crossed. But, you know, in the same breath, they're refusing to take action. That's the best that we have, a refusal to take action. And, you know, this one issue of so many others that this university has had, it's kicking the can further down the road. Even politicians, like, for example, Jagmeet Singh, they've gone and talked about the importance of free speech in this specific matter where we really have seen outright hatred. Was this how the convoy protest was covered, for example, where the existence of some hate speech or some groups that people didn't like? Absolutely not. The exact same politicians were going so hard against them. And, you know, now we see that there's an exception because, in my opinion, Jews are involved.
Okay. Let's take a call from Roger in Caledon. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Libby. I just want a couple of quick comments. First of all, I believe Diamond and Diamond has a class action lawsuit against universities across Canada for this reason. I'm just wondering if you have any you've heard anything about that.
I haven't had any updates. I don't think it's been certified yet. I don't know where it's at. And yeah, what's your comment, Roger? We're running out of time here.
The other comment was, you know, you have a lot of good guests on your show, obviously, but one doctor said it best, Libby. He said, you know what? The problem with society is learn to accept bad behavior, and it's wrong. And that's my comment, yeah.
Okay. On that note, thank you for your call, Roger. We wrap things up. Thanks so much. Yotam, goodbye. And Jay Solomon, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, we are taking another break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a warning by CSIS and also the first report by the Foreign Interference Inquiry when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Still with the fallout from the Middle East, CSIS is warning that the Israel-Hamas war has led to a spike in violent rhetoric from extremist actors that could prompt some in Canada to turn to violence. This as the Prime Minister has weighed in on the huge increase in anti-Semitism, also documented in a new report this morning from B'nai B'rith. So is there anything new in this warning? The numbers to call 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. 40. And let's bring in Phil Gursky, president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting and former senior strategic terrorism analyst at CSIS. Hi, Phil. How are you?
Good, Libby. How are you today?
Fine. So this warning from CSIS, is it a warning sort of after the fact, or really is it diplomatically talking about things getting even worse?
I think it's probably a bit of both, Libby. So, you know, we learned throughout the public inquiry and foreign influence and interference that the government of the day doesn't believe in intelligence. The prime minister threw CSIS under the bus. I'm pretty sure my former colleagues have been following this for quite some time. A lot of European security services have been warning, you know, way back to last October about the increase in rhetoric, the possibility of attacks. We here in Canada have not raised our threat level, which is a little surprising, but normally it raises in accordance with an intelligence warning that you get through your security services. But no, it's pretty obvious that when we talk about extremist rhetoric, we're talking about Islamist jihadist rhetoric, as far as I can tell. I'm sure there's been, you know, some increase in the far right as well, but the majority of the attacks that are taking place are still carried out by jihadis, and there's a lot of anger around the world about what Israel's doing in Gaza. So I'm not really surprised. I hope this time maybe the government actually listens to what CSIS says and doesn't ignore it.
We've heard, support for what happened on October the 7th, you know, from students or protesters who may or may not be students, from union leaders. Does that play into this?
I think it probably does. I mean, you know, we have this real conundrum, Libby. We've got a right to protest under the charter, right to freedom of expression. But clearly, some of these protests are being hijacked. We've seen Hamas flags being flown at the protests. We've seen reports that people are infiltrating the protests. These are not, you know, students at McGill, U of T, and UBC solely. These are our platforms are being used by people with extremist ideologies to sort of fan these flames. And this is why we're seeing a spike in anti-Semitism at synagogues against Jewish schools and Jewish businesses. So I think it is a very worrying sign. But again, I'm pretty confident in my former colleagues that work in counterterrorism at CSIS that they're on top of this and they're providing the government with the intelligence it needs to make better decisions and better policies.
Well, yeah, we'll see if that works. I also want to talk about the issue of foreign interference in our elections. Justice Marie-Josée Hogue concluded that there's ample evidence that foreign interference did occur in the 2019 and 2021 elections, and that it potentially impacted some votes and even possibly the results in a handful of ridings, but did not impact the overall outcome. China is seen as the main actor seeking to affect our electoral outcomes. And even though a lot of people thought that the report was less damning than they expected, she still sees this as a stain on our system. I also want to bring into this conversation Dr. Stephanie Carvin, Assistant Professor of International Affairs at Carleton University. Hi, Stephanie. How are you?
Hey, Libby. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you. So was this first report from her, was it kind of less damning than you would have expected?
You know, it's definitely sharper than a Johnson report. And, you know, last year there was the report, of course, former Governor General Johnson. He looked into the issue and then said, you know what, we looked into it. Not much to see here. And then that was met with outrage because of all the different leaks, everything that's been happening. So we've had this foreign interference inquiry. And it's even though she reaches the same conclusion, I would say the tone is markedly different. And, you know, as you point out, like she says, you know, on the first page of her report, she's like, we have a problem and it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. And the government needs to act now. So even if she does come to similar conclusions, I would say that the tone and the messaging of the report make it very clear in a way that perhaps the Johnson report didn't, of the nature and magnitude of the problem. And in that sense, I thought it was a very good report.
Phil, what's your take on it?
Well, I agree mostly with Stephanie on this. It certainly was a harsher report than the Johnson report, which was really a whitewash. Some of the conclusions that Justice Hogue drew, I was a little bit skeptical of about the, you know, results of the election. You know, she admitted that we can't tell how Canadians voted or why they voted that way, but I can say with, you know, a great deal of credibility that the election results weren't affected. So I'm not really sure about that. The thing is, you know, Libby, we've been down this road of public inquiries before. It's Canada's favorite sport next to hockey is public inquiries. And who knows what's going to happen with the recommendations. We've seen a government that doesn't take national security very seriously, doesn't take intelligence very seriously. So will they take the recommendations very seriously? And as for a stain on our democracy, it's much worse than that. A stain is what you leave on your couch when you're watching Netflix late at night. this has undermined our freedom to vote, the freedom of some Canadians to cast their ballots. And I think it has to be taken seriously, and I hope it is. And I hope the professionals in the room are going to have their say, and hopefully the government will pay some attention to it this time.
I'd like to give the numbers out again. We do have a few more minutes left on this topic. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-744-740. We're talking about the report, and it is just the first report on foreign interference in our elections. And Stephanie, I mean, one of the things I think that was underlined is that nomination meetings for candidates are one area where there is potentially abuse, and there are stories about Chinese students being bused to a nomination meeting vote for a candidate that would have been more favorable to China. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, so traditionally in Canada, the attitude of the government has been, all governments, we should say, is that, you know, there's a lot of scrutiny of elections, right? We have Elections Canada. We also have this small office no one's ever heard of called the Office of Office of the Elections Commissioner, which is actually in charge of investigating any kind of wrongdoing at any time that comes up during an election. However, nomination processes are largely governed by parties. Almost entirely governed by parties, right? We have decided as a democracy that political parties should be able to decide for themselves how their candidates are chosen. But she says very explicitly in the report that this is an opportunity for foreign interference. And, you know, kind of basically making the point that, yeah, okay, the elections may have been free and fair and the outcome may not have been affected, but there's a chance that the candidates were impacted by this foreign interference. So, right. So who people ultimately vote for may not be affected, but, you know, states can, you know, work their way into the system through this kind of largely ungoverned space. So it'll be interesting to see if the government does choose to move on this. We are expecting a large package of foreign interference legislation later today. But one of the things that I think is kind of interesting about this is, you know, the political parties don't want the government regulating what they do. There may be some irony in that. And I should say, like, going into the next election, at this point, most of the candidates have already been chosen, so it may already be too late.
Well, it's interesting on a personal note, on the weekend, I had dinner with friends, and one of them, she is originally Chinese, and she was talking about some of these things that she has witnessed, but she will not say anything or do anything because she's still got family in China, talking in pretty big detail about things that she's witnessed. It's not scientific, it's anecdotal, but, you know, I have no doubt that these type of things exist, Phil.
No, they do. And it's what we call transnational repression, where foreign states like China and India exert pressure on diasporas here in Canada. They threaten people to say, don't be critical of our regime. Don't go against our interests, because you do have family back home. And I can understand your friend's response to this. If she, in fact, does have family living in the PRC, the government can do whatever it wants to her family. And so she has to be very careful. And so it takes a very brave person here in Canada to stand up and say things that they know might put their family in danger. And it is going to spread. And I think Stephanie made a good point. Whatever happens to this report, and again, I'm not optimistic it's going to really make a great deal of difference. We're going into an election where Canadians are going to wonder, and wonder correctly, just how, you know, open and free and fair this vote's going to be. As for, you know, busing in candidates, can we at least not make a rule that the people at conventions should at least be Canadian citizens that are choosing candidates for election? I mean, you got to be Canadian to vote. Why shouldn't you have to be a Canadian to elect a candidate for your riding? It seems kind of silly, but as Stephanie said, parties don't want the feds, you know, homing in on their particular process, and I get that. But you know, if this is a stain
all
on
kinds
democracy,
of
wait for more stains coming down the road, Libby.
Yeah, there are all kinds of complaints about all kinds of nominations. Many of which have nothing to do with foreign interference. Now, before we wrap things up, you mentioned India. We had some Indian nationals arrested for the murder of Mr. Nijjar in British Columbia, Sikh activist, and the Indian government saying Canada harbors terrorists.
It speaks to, again, is the government ignoring the intelligence that's being provided by our security services? This is another stain on Canada. It's the fact we had a Canadian citizen killed on our watch by a foreign government.
Well, I think we need a little more proof that happened. Do we not, Stephanie?
Proof in what sense?
Proof that it was the Indian government was behind this.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, I think we're going to learn a lot more through the U.S. trials, which are, I believe, scheduled to start this year. The plot, appears to have been targeting four individuals, three of whom were based in Canada, one, unfortunately, who was killed, and another individual in the United States. And they recruit, like, the people who doing the recruitment ended up recruiting a source, I believe, for the narcotics agency in the United States, which was not like a great move on the spies part, I should say. But we're going to be learning about that plot, because apparently these four individuals, you know, the plot to kill all these four individuals was connected. So we'll learn more about that first, and learn about the Indian government's role in this. They've now suggested themselves that it was rogue elements with their own intelligence agencies. I'm not surprised they're saying that. But yeah, I mean, the key thing is here is that transnational repression, as Phil described it, is something that happens. There was a plot just a few weeks ago in Edmonton from the allegedly attached to the Rwandan government. The foreign interference report talks about Pakistan, talks about other countries. We know that Saudi Arabia has tried to kill people in Canada. It's not a rare thing, unfortunately, but we just don't hear a lot about it. But it's a real problem if foreign governments believe that they can kill individuals in Canada and get away with it.
Final question, and we have very little time left. Any big expectations for the measures that will come down, notably a foreign agent registry and all of that, Phil? Will it do
this
any good?
This would be the registry that's, 18 months and counting now, since they said they were going to make one. Look at Libby. Any piece of legislation or procedure that's going to make things better, I'm all in favor of. The devil's in the details. Who's going to run it? What information they can use to put people on a registry, how closely is it going to be monitored. So, yeah, I mean, I'll hold out some hope that something's going to happen, but the government is not in a hurry to create this registry, Libby. If they had been, we'd have it by now. So
okay.
I think it speaks volumes of what their priorities are.
I'm looking at the clock. We are plumb out of time. Thank you so much, Phil Gursky and Dr. Stephanie Carvin. Appreciate your insight. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.